Father Hardin, a member of the Society of Jesus, is professor of systematic theology at the Bellarmine School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago, Illinois. He is author of many books and articles published in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His latest book is Christianity in the 20th Century. Father Hardin is a lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises. He is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin.
Our second lecture is on the religious training of our superpersonality. Why talk on a subject like this? For several reasons. One diocese after another is introducing educational programs that are intended to develop the human person. Some of these programs are commendable, others not so commendable. And in more than one city, parents have organized and formed caucuses to protest what they consider ill-considered methods of training in personality development, especially where these methods rely heavily on naturalistic psychology or, and stress, the cultivation of the sexual side of a person to the detriment, so many parents believe, of certain fundamental Christian values. Needless to say, then, it is highly pertinent, it may even be impertinent, to speak about personality development, even if our title for the lecture speaks of the training of one's super personality. I trust this unusual terminology will not be obscure, and indeed will become clear before I get too deep into our conference. There are really two foci to our reflections, namely the concept of person and personality development. My purpose is to clarify both, while recognizing that personality is only the abstract notion of what a person is supposed to be. We are persons. We have a personality. Depending on the concept of person, our attitude toward personality or superpersonality development will be shaped accordingly. Our order of coverage will be in two stages. What is the concept of person from reason, or if you wish, from philosophy? And what is the concept of person from Christian revelation? And therefore, what consequences follow in authentic Christian education based, it is presumed, on revelation? First, then, the evidence from reason. I think a word of preliminary comment is necessary as we begin to ask, what is the concept of person known to unaided reason? We are speaking here about the notion of person in the Western world, which is essentially the Euro-American world. Why? Because in the Oriental world of Hinduism and Buddhism, born of the Vedas and Upanishads, the notion of person is radically different. In the Oriental world, a person is either a mere illusion called Maya, which is the Sanskrit for illusion, or person is part of an endless cycle of reincarnations called Samsara, or person is somehow identified with the impersonal absolute called Brahman. For our purpose, we transmit these notions as outside the scope of our inquiry. One reason for inserting this parenthesis is that my work professionally is teaching the Oriental religions. But in the Western world, as known to the sages of philosophy, already prior to and outside of Judeo-Christianity, a person has certain easily definable qualities. 5, to be exact, all of which stem from one fundamental property. Succinctly defined, a person is an individual, rational being. His nature is, of course, human, but he is a person because and insofar as he is an individual. This individuality means that a person is, first, separate from other individuals, which is obviously clear from the fact that we each have our own separate bodies. There is an edge to me and a beginning to you. Secondly, each person is different from other individuals. No two, even perfect twins, are really alike. Thirdly, each individual is distinctive from other persons, since each one has his or her own characteristic temperament and qualities, as mothers discover shortly after a child is born. Fourth, each individual is autonomous, insofar as each person's activities are truly his own and not someone else's. It is for this reason we say that each person is, and we always add, personally responsible for his own human actions, and correspondingly he is the object of his own personal rights and prerogatives. Lastly, as a kind of synthesis of all these qualities, each person is simply unique. There is only one such person, whoever he is, and no other. And this uniqueness, as the wisdom of human philosophy has taught, is partly determined by a person's ancestry, having this father and mother and none other. It is secondly determined by his training and environment, different for different people. But it is also determined, and for our purpose, importantly, his uniqueness is determined by his own deliberate choices and a lifetime of his own consciously free actions, we shape our own personalities. So much for a resume of what human reason can tell us about the concept of person. Now for the evidence from Christian revelation. When Christianity came along, it did not deny or exclude any of these foregoing elements, so carefully accumulated by the studies of men like Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. But it added such depth and understanding as the non-Christian sages of history had never conceived. And it did so on two levels. On the level of clarifying the meaning of individuality, which is at the heart of personality, and on the level of amplifying the meaning of individuality beyond anything known with full certitude, even in the religion of the ancient Jews. What did Christian revelation do to clarify the meaning of individuality? It told its believers that each of us is an individual from the first moment of our human existence, when God specially creates for each person his own unique and separate soul. In other words, God is not only the original author of human nature, he is, at the moment a child is conceived, the author of every single and distinct human person. What did Christian revelation do to clarify the meaning of individuality? It told its believers that each of us is an individual from the first moment of our human existence, when God specially creates for each person his own unique and separate soul. In other words, God is not only the original author of human nature, he is, at the moment a child is conceived, the author of every single and distinct human person. From this it follows that in the basic sense of the term, there is no such thing as becoming a person. We are persons from the instant in God's eternity that he decided to create, that is, make out of nothing, our own and no one else's immortal spirit, and infuse it into the bodies prepared for the infusion by our human parents. It is an article of the Catholic faith, solemnly defined by the Church, that God separately, distinctly, individually creates each human soul, and at the moment of conception infuses that spirit which he, the infinite God, created to be united with this body. Again, still on the level of clarification, Christianity told its followers that this spirit, once created, is to remain itself for all eternity.
I might add, this is not the thinking of the Oriental mind, which believes in what it calls the transmigration of one spirit from one person into, shall we say, another. The question then arises, is it one person or many persons? Christianity is absolutely clear. Once my spirit is created, it remains itself into eternity. It, of course, can be mutilated or vitiated. It can be improved or sublimated. But absolutely speaking, there is no such thing ever as ceasing to be myself. Once brought into being, I, the person, will never cease to be. Consequently, there is no such thing as ever losing one's personality. It can, of course, become better or worse, but it can never cease to be. More important for us, however, is what Christian revelation taught and teaches by way of amplifying the concept of person and personality as known to reason. It added three dimensions that can be expressed in three words, and they are the bedrock of sound Christian training in personality development. Without taking full account of these three dimensions, you may have development. You will not even have authentic personality development. You will certainly not have Christian development of personality. These three terms are grace, incarnation, and the church. Include these dimensions, and human development is adequate and all that it should be. Exclude them, and you deprive a person of his greatest potential for authentic maturity. For the rest of the lecture, I will in each case repeat the Christian amplification and treat it under the dual aspect of meaning and educational implications. Thus first, grace, mystery, and consequences.
We ask, what does the mystery of grace add to the concept of person as known to the unrevealed human mind?
It tells us that each human being has a second and higher life infused into him by God than the already sublime existence conferred on him at the moment of conception. This we saw in our previous lecture. But it also says that we should speak not only of a supernatural life conferred on humanity, but of a superpersonal individuality uniquely and distinctively and differently
conferred on each person the moment he receives the divine life of grace into his already unique human spirit. What are we saying? We are saying that our personality, by Christian standards, is individuality twice over. Once because we have our own distinctive, separately conferred soul, which makes us a human person with a body and a spirit, distinct from all other human beings. But once again, because we have our own distinctive, separately conferred soul of the soul, or in Augustine's phrase, anima anime, which is God's special gift to those who are in His grace. Several consequences follow for Christian education. First, a warning. In teaching or training others, we dare not fail to recognize that each person has two forms of individuality. And we should begin speaking in pedagogical circles not only of the supernatural life, but of the superpersonal life. And that just as the one needs nurture and development, so does the other. We are, as a result, to help the educand who has both a supernatural and superpersonal life within him to foster both and foster them both simultaneously and not mistakenly halt the one process while encouraging the other. And a child is a super person from the moment the divine life is infused into his soul at baptism. What would be the consequences if we failed to take account of developing both personalities simultaneously? We should run the risk of producing what are, in effect, split personalities, where one part of the personality, the natural one, is cultivated to the nth degree, while neglecting the other part, or what I call the other personality, the supernatural, or for our purpose, the superpersonal one. For having failed to cultivate both levels of personality simultaneously from infancy, we now see the spectacle of graduates from nominally Catholic institutions leaving school as cultivated agnostics. Of religious men and women thoroughly skilled in some science or academic discipline,
but adolescence, and I might add, retarded adolescence, in things of the Spirit, of priests ordained to the sacred ministry, who know all about the latest theory of morals, or the most advanced ideas in process theology, but irresponsible boys in understanding the ways of God with man. Moreover, I am still on the level of consequences. As parents and teachers, we should recognize that there are two sides to developing a person's autonomy, which is surely essential to his personality. Remember, we said a person's autonomy is part of his individuality. So much was known, though dimly, by the wise men before, and is now known by the wise men outside of Christianity. An autonomy was normally and correctly seen as developed by the right use of one's free will. In other words, if I wish to develop the natural side of my personality, an essential part of which is autonomy, I cultivate a balanced use, a wise use of my human freedom. But what the wisdom of philosophy never knew was that this free will must be enlightened by grace, must be supported by grace, must be empowered by grace to do things which reason alone could never conceive, or free volition alone could never achieve. In other words, the poet Henley, to the contrary notwithstanding, we are not, emphatically, we are not each the master of our own souls. My free will needs grace.
This conference is continued on Side B.